Okay. So the question then becomes, what is Kabbalah? How do we approach it? Where do we start? It's like being at the foot of Mount Everest and trying to figure out how to get to the top while standing, you know, in a valley at the bottom. The way we're going to approach it is to show you that Kabbalah is divided up into three major areas of interest, three approaches. There are three paths to the top, or shall we say to the bottom, of this material. The first one is theory. There is a theoretical aspect to tarot. The second aspect of Kabbalah is meditation. The third is magic. So theory, meditation, and magic are three quite separate but related ways in which Kabbalah can be approached. Now theory is made up of a couple of things. First of all, the theory of Kabbalah is a blueprint of creation. That's a really important point. It's the master plan. There are more than one, of course, but it is one version of a master plan, very, very detailed, and very interesting, and very deep, and very subtle, of how the world came to be, of how human beings came to be, and of the relationship between human beings, the world, and divinity. I'm going to mention to you, by the way, if you didn't already know this, that Kabbalah is absolutely rooted in a conviction that God exists. So, we're not going to...
Can you repeat that, Walt?
I say Kabbalah is rooted, totally and deeply rooted, in a conviction that God exists. It's the same God that we know of in Judaism, in Christianity, and in Islam, all called by different names, but having essentially the same root. There are, these days, any number of people who find the traditional religions have become in some way irrelevant, or some way uncomfortable, or in some way not acceptable, but nevertheless, this is where Kabbalah comes from. I think you'll find that in the long run, the way in which Kabbalah works with this primary belief will be not unhappy for you, even if you're feminist or Wiccan, or involved in any other form of spirituality. I think you will not find this difficult to deal with. So, but bear that in mind. Second of all, Kabbalah is a map of the invisible realm. And I say that in particular, it's invisible. It's a map of the invisible. How do you manage to do that? Maps are normally understood to be maps of what is very visible. You go down, you know, a valley, you map it. You go down a river, you can see it, and you can put it on a map. You come to an ocean or a shore. Whatever it happens to be is actually in the physical world, and once it's in the physical world, you can put it down on paper. But how do you make a map of the invisible? Kabbalah's job is to do that. Because from the point of view of Kabbalah, the visible universe and all of its forms and forces is only the very last step. It's not the only step there is. It's not the only universe there is, or the only way of understanding it. It's the last step in a long process. And from the point...
That's just delicious. That's an absolutely delicious thing to say, Walt. Thank you for saying it.
You're very welcome. The thing is that from the point of view of Kabbalah, a great deal more of the process of existence is invisible than is visible. Well, if you want to measure it, you could say there's three times more area invisible than there is visible. And it is so subtle and so magnificent and so beautiful and so deep that the people who go to explore this area, they oftentimes become lost. You know how it's possible? There's a danger in doing scuba diving. If you go down too deep and you stay too long, you become intoxicated. And you become disoriented, and you can't find your way back to the surface, and you eventually drown. And the same thing is true here. In this material, it's possible to become intoxicated, to lose one's bearings and one's orientation, and to drown in the invisible universe and not to be able to put your foot back in the ordinary everyday world again. And that's happened to more people than you would imagine. You guys don't have to worry about it at this point because we're going to be in the shallows for quite a while. But it gets pretty deep out there.
I was told a long time ago when I got into this, if you understood, once you've got an understanding of Kabbalah, you could go back and read the Bible, Christian Bible, and understand it a lot better than just say, from your traditional religion standpoint.
Absolutely.
And that it would just make so much more sense.
What happens is that Kabbalah is essentially the esoteric interpretation of the Bible.
Okay.
That's where it comes from. That's where it goes back to. And if you were a Bible student, if your interest was not in tarot, but your interest was in biblical matters, you would find that the Bible would open up for you like an oyster, and inside would be a pearl of understanding that there would be no way to know about did you not have Kabbalah as an avenue.
And also with astrology as well. When you study one, you could just basically take Kabbalah and you can go through all these systems and just get a perfect, much better understanding.
That's right. What happens is that at the root, magical material and occult studies eventually become unified.
Mm.
And this is the place where that happens. You're absolutely right. So, what we have then is that Kabbalah becomes a systematic exploration of the invisible origins of the visible universe. Here you sit in this absolutely stunning creation, and all of the investigation that science lavishes, it lavishes on the visible. Not necessarily what you can see with your eyes, but what you can see with instruments, what you can see with the mind, but it is still the physical universe with all of its forms and forces. And that is where the attention of science is lavished. Religion pretty much pays attention to the invisible only. And since it can't be proven, science isn't interested. And magic kind of goes over the bounds of the two. It works with the invisible and the visible both, and it sees them as a unified, as a unified matter, as a unified field. And that's what we're going to be looking at here. Tarot, by the way, is very much about that. As a matter of fact, I should say before I mention tarot that Kabbalah is finally a portrait of what it means to be human, what it means to be divine, what it means to exist. That's what Kabbalah is meant to accomplish. That's what the theory of Kabbalah is meant to accomplish. And tarot is that same exact portrait done as a deck of cards. You may or may not have realized when you hold the tarot deck in your hands that you're actually holding a picture of the workings of the invisible universe. Very, very carefully laid out and very, very intricate and thorough. The entire system is held there in the palm of your hand if you knew what you were holding. So, that's the theory part, and that's mostly what we're going to be dealing with. The second part, the second avenue to an understanding of Kabbalah is through meditation. And there what we're looking at is states of consciousness. We're looking at very specific techniques for altering and changing states of consciousness, which is a very magical thing to do. But in this case, it's not used for magical purposes. It's used for entirely meditative purposes. It's used to transcend the normal state of awareness. Levels of being, different ways of existing, different perceptions of yourself can be accomplished by means of permutations of the letters of Hebrew, the letters of the names of God. It can be done very specifically with a great deal of learning and a great deal of effort and many, many austerities and spiritual practices. And it can also be done in tarot, and in especially in tarot, in the form of pathworking. Some of you may have heard about pathworking. I may not know exactly what it is, but I can tell you that pathworking is the tarot version, or one tarot version, of Kabbalistic meditation. We are not going to be able to deal with that tonight or for this in this course, other than to mention that it exists. It is a whole universe unto itself, and it is beautiful beyond belief. And that's where you go into the deep ocean and get lost. Here's an interesting other thing. There are two words to describe this business of states of consciousness and the business of study and what you can do with it. There is a Hebrew word that is called derech. Derech, which we can transliterate as D-E-R-E-K-H. That K-H has a slightly guttural sound to it. Derech is a road. And it's a road that's something like a highway. You know, when you go down, when you get on the interstate, and you know, there are signs that tell you where the entrances are. There's an entrance ramp, and a sign that tells you whether to go north or south, east or west, and what the highway number is. And when you get on the highway, there are signs posted about how fast you can go and where, you know, there are rest stops and what towns are up ahead. And it gives you a pretty general idea of what's going on, and you feel fairly comfortable and safe when you're on the interstate because everything is marked out for you. And plenty of time so that you can do what you have to do and get off where you have to get off and go where you have to go. And you can look at a map, and you can see on the map the long, broad line of the interstate highways, you know, crossing the countryside. It's easy to follow. And everybody on the highway has the same ease and general awareness that you do. That's the highway of Kabbalah. And there's plenty of that, and we're going to be working mostly with that. There is a second word that describes another way to deal with Kabbalah, and this is where the meditational forms come in to some extent. And that word is nativ. And it's spelled N-A-T-I-V, almost like native, except no E on the end, nativ. And a nativ is a path, a private path, an unknown path, a hidden path, no signposts, no rest stops, filled with perils and shadows and unknown things. It leads you know not quite where, and it starts you don't know quite where, and it winds its way through the woods. It's a back road, a country road, a path through unknown territory. And everybody has his own. Each person who studies this material has his own or her own way of dealing with the material that's presented to them. And when you follow these things out far enough, when you work with this material and you find yourself out in the lonely places, you know, of personal investigation, that is where the nativ comes in. And so you leave the main highway and you go off on your own. And I can tell you that when it comes to studying Kabbalah and Tarot, there is a way in which every teacher, everybody who teaches this material, will teach it in their own way. They have traveled their own path to get there. Their understanding is built on personal experience and personal predilection. So I can tell you that I see things in ways that possibly my colleagues in this study would find interesting, amusing, and not what they would think of as Kabbalah. There are some places where we would disagree, and everybody who studies finds themselves in the same position. They will find places where they agree and places where they don't. General areas of acceptance and certain specialized places where each person goes off on their own. I have a friend who has devoted most of his life to the study and practice of Kabbalah, and he once told me, he said, "Oh, wow, that's extremely interesting stuff. Not Kabbalah, though." And I laughed. Because, of course, he was right. And he was also not right. So be aware that whenever you're working with a teacher, you're working with a personal approach. That goes whether you're working with a rabbi or a ceremonial magician or, you know, some local teacher at your metaphysical store. It doesn't matter. Everybody who teaches this material teaches it from their own perspective. Very similar to tarot, actually. Does anybody find that a difficult or uncomfortable way of approaching something? Would you like to see it nailed down and absolute? Would you like to see it as clear and as agreed upon as the fact that 2 + 2 = 4? Or are you comfortable with a slightly blurred edges?
I'm okay with it.
Is anybody here uncomfortable with that idea, with the feeling that it's not 100%, 1,000% nailed down? Okay, I'm going to take that silence as being an acceptance of that general idea. That's what we're going to do. Then we come to the third branch of this study, the third avenue, the third doorway, and that is magic. there is a whole universe of magical practice that centers around and turns around Kabbalistic knowledge, Kabbalistic signs, Kabbalistic conceptions, and Kabbalistic formulas and statements and methodology. From that magic, incantations were born. Signs and seals and sigils were made. And this is European stuff. This is old-fashioned stuff. This is goes back many hundreds of years. Amulets and talismans come from this work. Words of power that presumably allow the various spirits in the unseen, invisible universe to enter and interact with people here, with the world at large. In that area are also invocations and banishments. Some of you, I don't know if any of you have actually done any work with ceremonial magic. Have any of you ever done the lesser banishing of the pentagram or things like that?
Yes, I have. This is Gail.
Okay. So you're aware that it exists. Some of the rest of you, if you have never done it, you may not know that it exists. But that material comes straight out of Kabbalistic work. Straight out. All the work the magicians do with angels and demons comes straight out of this material. Kabbalah has a vast repertory of knowledge and practice connected with angels and demons. And it may be, and this is historically more or less lost, I don't think that anybody could say for sure, who could say that they were the founder or the origin of this particular information or knowledge. But it is so old, so very, very old. And Kabbalah has been working with this from the beginning. So at least it has several thousand years of work with both angels and demons and the means and methods of calling them up and using them. It's a very specialized field, not for everybody. How many of you would feel comfortable with the idea that you could, if you wished, learn to summon and send out on missions demons and angels?
No, I think I'm comfortable with it.
Oh, yeah? does anybody here feel that demons and angels don't exist? That there aren't any such things? I mean, just by instinct, how do you feel about it?
I feel they exist.
Do you have anything to back that up? Any experience or knowledge that would tell you that that was true, other than just a feeling?
Well, this is Adela. I don't know how this ties in, but I personally experienced being in the presence of someone who's possessed.
Aha. Uh-huh. That certainly would be a powerful experience if you had ever had that.
It was terrifying.
I'm certain that it was. It is perhaps, it may be the most terrifying thing that you will ever confront. In fact, it probably is the source, the essence of terror, to be in the presence of a demon, whether by possession or in some other way. I don't think it's possible that the root of terror in a human being, the root of terror in the psychological mechanism of a human being, comes from originally the confrontation with demons. Possibly with angels too, but from another perspective. So when you're working with Kabbalistic material, if you were working with Kabbalah as a magical tool, you would be working with the primal forces of terror and awe. You would be working with forces so far beyond the standard forces of nature and the forces of the everyday that your mind would buckle under the impact. So that's another area of Kabbalah that might send you over the deep end. Another aspect of magic in Kabbalah is that it is, well, we mentioned that it's the root of ceremonial magic, but also it's the root of Wicca, modern Wicca. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Wiccan stuff. Any of you?
Slightly.
Okay,
I'm
slightly.
Familiar with it.
Okay. Well, sometimes when we have these classes, a number of the women who take part in it are very familiar with Wiccan material, but modern day Wicca is strongly derived from exactly the same material. that's another story. Since none of you are particularly involved in it, I won't get into that, but just be aware that it's so. And the last thing that I'll mention now, it's not the end of the story, but the last thing that I'll mention at this moment is that the manipulation of the astral plane belongs here. All those things that deal with the out-of-body experience, everything that has to do with ghosts, everything that has to do with spirits, the spirits of the dead, speaking to the dead, mediumship, transship, channeling, all comes through the astral plane. And Kabbalah was probably the very first of the, at least the Western forms, of making that happen. It's the only way that I know of where that kind of thing can actually be controlled, manipulated, pretty much on demand, rather than waiting for spirits to take possession or some other such thing. Traveling on the astral plane and manipulating the astral plane and all the creatures that abide there is part of the magical area, the magical landscape of Kabbalah. We have theory and meditation and magic. And through these three things, and the manipulation and work with the invisible universe, Kabbalah gives a human being access to tremendous amounts of power, personal and otherwise. Magic, by the way, I can tell you, is meant to have an impact on the everyday world. Magic is meant to change and manipulate the nature of the visible. Meditation is not. Meditation is entirely internal. Meditation's purpose is to manipulate and improve and empower the soul and the spirit. And you'd never know to look at somebody whether that was true of them or not. Theory is meant for philosophers. Theory is meant for students. Theory is meant to organize and hold all this material in books and in systems. But all of it is implicit in tarot. And all of it is available to the student of tarot. You didn't know, I bet, that you actually stand in the presence of an instrument that is capable of holding all of this material and manipulating it. Did you know that when you pick up a tarot deck that all of that is there for you?
No.
Yes.
Okay. Well, hopefully, as we go along, you will know that not only is it true, but you'll know how it's true.
Yeah.
Or at least up to a certain point. And if you had any reservations about whether or not tarot and Kabbalah as a combination were interesting or potentially useful, I'm hoping that at this point you're willing to grant that they do have a reason to be together and there is a reason to know. And I'm assuming that most of you would enjoy the prospect of becoming personally more powerful. No?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How many of you, when you look at yourself in the mirror or think of yourself, regard yourselves as essentially small creatures? You know, more or less at the mercy of the powers of the world. You can't alter politics. You can't stop wars by yourself. You can almost not even hold your own tongue. Self-control is almost out of the question for most of us, never mind controlling the events of the world. We normally don't feel very powerful. Some people are. Some people have so much spirit, they have so much inner fire, that they think that they can, that they realize that they can. In some cases, they actually do. Individuals have been known to change the world often, but most of us, most of the time, don't feel that way about ourselves. This will show you that every human being, not just you, but everyone, is powerful beyond imagination. You really can't believe how strong, how immense a human being is. But this will begin to show you. Is that something that pleases you?
Sounds exciting.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to leave that kind of hanging in the air as a kind of a promise. Let me do a little bit more. I guess what I should do at this point is to give you a sense of what tarot was like these days in connection with the Kabbalah of the old days. There was a time when tarot decks were used for playing games. And that's pretty much what it was used for. There was a time when decks of cards, whether tarot or otherwise, served the enormously powerful purpose of making people enjoy their lives. I mean, you know how much fun people get out of playing cards. And tarot is a combination, seems to be a combination, of a regular playing card deck and a group of trumps, a group of special cards. And those trumps might have been added to the regular playing card deck sometime early on. We don't know whether it was an addition or whether the deck was conceived as a unit. But what happened was that the idea of the trump originally was the idea of the triumph. The trump is actually a kind of anglicization of the word triumph, trionfi in Italian. And the triumph was a list or a group of specialized characters that represented some of the most vivid and the most present and the most universally applicable of life experiences in the form of death and justice and time and the fool. And all of those cards were archetypes. Literally, they were things that you would encounter on the road of your life. And they were added to the minor arcana in a way that allowed the triumphs to literally triumph over the events of daily life. That's why they were called trionfi. And they became the trumps. And they became, in game terms, they became the source of the idea of the trump that we find in bridge and hearts and various other trick-taking games of the modern day. That was the source of the idea of the trump in playing cards. And to this day, I believe, tarot is still played as a game in various places in Europe. Not here so much, but in Europe, yes. There came a time, I might mention, somewhere early on, I believe, I don't know, I'm not exactly sure of the history of divination, but I do believe that tarot was essentially a divinatory form for a long time. It was used to tell fortunes. It was a parlor game. It wasn't actually considered or used for anything particularly magical, but it was a parlor game. And they did use it that way, and it was probably about the same kind of quality that it has today at a party. If you do readings at a party, people get all tittery, and they love to have their fortunes told and their cards read. And it's pretty much the same thing in the court of Milan or Sicily or wherever it happened to be that the cards were used. And that stayed the same for a very long time. And there came a time when the cards were perceived as having a connection to the magical universe. That didn't happen early, it happened quite late in their development, and I'm going to tell you about that in a moment.